2010. For the record, we have a part of the committee here, not all the committee, with the number of meetings that are going on throughout the building, but given that we're not hearing legislation or taking any formal action today, we will start without a quorum. At the table, we do have Representative Tuck, who's a member of the committee, and would like to thank Representative Neil Foster for sitting in for the short time that he has this afternoon. The purpose of today's meeting is to have sort of a semi-structured conversation about services being provided to rural Alaska regarding energy and what the strengths and weaknesses might be of the various programs that are out there, and what the organizations and entities that do provide those services, what recommendations that they might provide us, knowing that this session energy is a significant issue. We have a number of substantial policy legislative items that are, at least in my estimation, probably going to work their way through the process. So if there's an opportunity in terms of being able to contribute to that, today's hearing, we think, is going to be pretty valuable to maybe provide some insight along those lines. I know there's some deadlines in terms of folks needing to go to other meetings. So what I'd like to do, and we'll be expecting other committee members to trickle in as we sort of begin to work our way through the list of folks that we have. What I'd like to do before I announce, or actually let me step back here for a second and announce that the roundtable participants that we have lined up include Bob Breen from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Bob's the Director of Research and Development. Amir Kohler with AVEC, or the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Steve Hagenson is with Alaska Energy Authority. I understand that Joel Niemeyer is available as well with the Nelly Commission. And Tara Jolly is actually here in Juneau. She's the director of the Division of Community Regional Affairs. We had hoped to have more people here in person, but the fog this morning wouldn't allow the planes to land. So we have largely our group of participants participating by phone, but that is all well and good too. And knowing that that time is a constraint for the folks at the Department of Health and Social Services, we did ask them to come forward and at least give us an update on the LIHEAP program and how that's working as we move into March and so forth, and the second year of the ACAP program. So if Ron, if you and whoever you want to bring with you, if you'd come to the table, introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation, and we would appreciate the time that you have. I understand you've got a 3:30 commitment over on the Senate side, so if you want to just sort of give us a general overview of where the program is today and how it it's faring in terms of people participating as well.
Thank you very much, Representative Edgeman. My name is Ron Creer. I'm Chief Field Operations for the Division of Public Assistance, and in that role I oversee the operations for the state's heating assistance programs through my regional manager. I also, here with me is Ellie Fitzgerald, the director of the Division of Public Assistance, and Susan Marshall, who's the program coordinator for the heating assistance program. Keep an eye on them. If they start to fidget or they're dodging for the door, it might be a good time to ask me a question. I think what I'd like to do, if it's all right, Mr. Chairman, is just kind of give an overview of the program, very much of a thumbnail. It's hard to really describe the intricacies of the program in a brief and concise manner, but I will do my best for the benefit
Ron,
of the committee.
Before you start, I think we have Co-Chair Millett on line. Sharice, are you on the phone? We have our list.
I am. I'm here, Representative Edgen.
Okay, excellent. Good to hear you, Sharice. I want the record to reflect that, she is participating by phone. And Sharice, we're expecting a number of our members to show up here shortly. I think there's a transportation meeting that's continuing on, and hopefully we'll get them here shortly. But Ron, if you'd proceed, please.
Certainly. Our heating assistance programs are going great guns. We're in the middle of our program year right now. It started on November 1st issuing benefits, and it runs through. We accept applications through the end of April 30th. We have essentially two programs that operate pretty much the same except for differing income limits. We have the federally funded LIHEAP program, which serves families below 150% of poverty, and then we have the state-funded Alaska Heating Assistance Program, which serves families between 150 and 225% of poverty. Last year, in 2009, the state of Alaska served 10,983 families through the LIHEAP program. Tribal organizations, which also receive direct funding from the feds, a portion of the block grant for the state served almost 7,000 households, 6,833. Our Alaska Heating Assistance Program served a total of 2,047 households in Alaska in 2009, and tribal organizations operating regional Alaska Heating Assistance Programs served 339 households. So overall, a total of 20,119 households were served through the heating assistance program last year. It looks like this year that we're going to have very similar numbers. Our application volume is what we would expect to see this time of the year, so we anticipate serving roughly the same number of households, maybe a few more at the most.
So, Ron, when you say last year, are you meaning 2008-2009?
Yes, sir.
That would be October 2008 till April 2009?
Correct.
Okay.
So it Representative Edgerman, it's always gets a little confusing because we have our state fiscal year. The program runs, the federal program is funded, of course, under the federal fiscal year cycle. So, but when I mentioned last year, 2009, that's correct, from the start of the program year in 08, ending in 09.
Okay, and I'd like the record to reflect that the Vice Chair Johansson has joined us, as well as Representative Peterson.
We, both of these programs are statewide. Everybody that's eligible for the program in any community in the state is served. Our state program serves 163 communities, and we have approximately 120 communities that are served by tribal organizations across the state. In some instances, depending on those plans, Juneau is a good example. Clinkett and Haida Regional Housing Authority is our tribal grantee here for our ACHAP program and for our LIHEAP program. So they serve Alaska Natives in the Juneau area, and our state program serves non-Natives, just as an example, and that happens in some other communities as well. We've got 11 tribal organizations administering heating assistance for LIHEAP, and of those 11, 8 also are signed up to be regional ACHAP providers. We've got Aleutian Privilofs, the Association of Village Council Presidents, Bristol Bay Native Association, Kenaitse Indian Tribe, the Kodiak Area Native Association, Kuskokwim Native Association, Arutsaramute Native Council in Bethel, Seldovia Village Tribe, Tanana Chiefs Conference, Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority, and the Yakutat Tlingit Tribe. All of these organizations, tribal organizations, receive their funding from the amount for the LIHEAP program of a share of the block grant that comes to the state of Alaska. And we use the same formula that the feds use to distribute federal dollars to distribute state dollars to tribes that are operating Alaska heating assistance programs in their service areas. The tribes administer about 30% of the state general funds that are going to tribal participants in the program, and about the same percentage of the federal money goes to them, and they use that to serve tribal communities. The program is driven off of something we refer to that's referred to as community heating points. Every community in Alaska we use the ACWARM system, which is something that AHFC uses to for their programs as well to determine community heating points. And basically, we're looking at house types, where the household is, and the where the community is located, community heating degree days, to come up with a number that is looked at as being the base for determining the heating needs for that household. So once somebody's submitted an application, they're residing in the community, in the home that they've identified on the application, we then look at that information on their application and determine how many points, community heating points, the household is eligible for. So it's going to be based on their household type, their income, the type of fuel they use, and what community they're living in. And based on that, we will then calculate their temporary, just in a meeting where we're talking about temporary assistance, and that stuck in my mind, we calculate their heating assistance award. Typically, that is done by calculating a price or a value for those community heating points. And we do that based on the anticipated funding that we're going to receive, the number of households we project receiving, and then looking at the average number of community heating points that were issued in the prior year. So, for example, this year, based on our federal funding, we were able to calculate that we are going to be able to pay for LIHEAP $115 per community heating point. So a household that receives 10 points will get $1,150 for a heating assistance award that will go to the vendor of their choice or who they typically get their heating fuels from. Generally speaking, we think that the heating assistance programs as they're designed are meeting a portion of the household's need, but of course not the entire household's need for heating assistance. It's generally considered to be a supplement to households' incomes and other sources. But the program is set up so that the lowest income households and the households that are in have the largest number of heating degree days are going to get the largest awards. So for instance, the maximum payment that you can, number of community heating points is much higher in a community such as Anaktuvuk Pass as opposed to Anchorage. And that's because of the difference in heating degree days, the difficulty in getting fuel there and things of that nature. So it's the program is heavily weighted towards providing the most benefit to the lowest income households and the lowest income households that are at the greatest need for heating assistance. So while in the state's program, the majority of our population that we serve is in rural communities because we've got 11 tribal organizations serving rural areas, while up to over 50% of the population is in an urban area, and I'm using a very loose term for urban. It's basically Anchorage and Fairbanks and other communities in the Mat-Su Valley. Only about 30% of the actual payments go to those communities. The bulk of it is still going out to the rural communities because of the higher community heating points and the lower incomes that are typically found in those communities.
So, Ron, what you're saying is that the number of participants is larger in the urban communities, but that the larger amount of payouts you were just saying a second ago goes out to the smaller communities dispersed throughout the state. Is that?
Yes, that's correct.
Accurate?
Yes.
Is that for both the ACCAP and the LIHEAP programs?
It works out the same way for both programs. We have the very same point system is used. One of the other intricacies of the point system also and how the benefit is calculated, depending on where you fall in the income brackets, you're going to get a higher percentage of points. So if your income is zero, you're going to get 100% of the allowable points. And then as you move up in income brackets, you get a smaller percentage of those points. So by the time you get to the ACCAP program, and I think I've actually got that document here, you're earning something along the lines of 40% of the points when you get above 150%, and then when you're at 220% of poverty, your income, you get 30% of the allowable points, and then down to 20. So it spreads out the dollars based on your income bracket as well. So a household in Anaktuvuk Pass that's up at 225% of the poverty is going to get significantly fewer points than a similarly situated person in that community that has zero income. But compared to somebody in an urban area, they're still going to get a little higher benefit. And I don't know if the members got the packets, but at the back of them there's a little sheet that shows the gallons of fuel covered by an award, and you can kind of see how that spread works out It has Anchorage. The average number of points was 6. And this is looking at oil. So you can see that depending on where you are in the state, how those awards trickle out in basically what you may be able to purchase based on the current fuel prices in those communities. That's really it in the most gruesome or shortest nutshell possible. The program, I think, is certainly meeting significant needs for people, low-income households across the state, especially in rural Alaska. Our challenge always is the funding levels. The federal funding levels can be somewhat of a guess at times, although it has been fairly stable. 2009 was really an interesting anomaly for us. We got pretty much federal block grant had been fairly stable for a couple of years, but then we got significant emergency contingency funds, and then the largesse of the legislation and two special appropriations brought another $19 million to the programs. So in last year, we had roughly $51 million total to use towards energy assistance, and it was beneficial in many ways because the price of fuel was so high last year in so many communities. This year, it's a different picture. We've got $5 million appropriated for the Alaska Heating Assistance Program, and our share of the federal block grant was significantly less than before because we have lower emergency contingency funds primarily. And our total block grant for this year was $25 million, of which roughly $9 million goes to the tribal organizations. So we're looking at quite a bit less money this year. And we're already getting calls from clients who are applicants who are surprised that their award is about half of what they got last year. It's largely driven by the funding.
Questions, committee members? Representative Foster, do you have any questions or comments while you're here?
No, I appreciate it, though. Thank you.
I guess I have one.
Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that, I'm trying to remember the president's name of Venezuela, I believe it is.
Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chavez. I know that he's been doing some sort of assistance. Does that go through your organization as well, or is that bypassed and goes directly to the community?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, it does not come through us. People apply through that for that through other avenues.
Representative Foster.
So I guess I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If somebody receives fuel through the CITGO program, I assume that does not affect what they would be eligible for under the LIHEAP or the ACAP program, does it?
Representative Foster, through the chair, that's correct. It does not count.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions, Representative Johansson?
Yeah, I was looking at page 6 under eligibility. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm filling out an application right now, but if we go point by point, I think I would qualify. I think. So somebody like me could get heating assistance for my house?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, if you met all the eligibility criteria and submitted an application, conceivably you could, yes.
Wow, that's good to know. I need to declare a conflict, Mr. Chair. That's interesting. That's very interesting. Thank you.
Well, the assumption is that you don't heat your home with electricity. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just mentioned a couple minutes ago that last year you paid out $51 million or over $51 million. How much are you? How much do you have in your budget this year? How much less are you going to be expecting to pay out?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, this year our funding level is momentarily lost in this pile of papers. Our total funding this year is $32 million. $32.6 million, a portion of which goes to our tribal organizations. So as a result of that, we adjusted our dollar per point value significantly using the formula I mentioned earlier, where we look at our average number of points statewide, our anticipated caseload, and then we simply divide that into our block rent after we've taken out, of course, the pittance, really, that we use for our administrative costs relative to the size of the award. So we're looking at about $115 per community heating point this year.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your opinion, is $2.6 million adequate?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, it's hard to quantify and to qualify that, given the nature of challenges that many households face currently throughout the state, given the nature of work opportunities. When we look at how the kind of impacts we're seeing in some of our other public assistance programs, large growth in food stamps, you know, kind of upticks in Medicaid, it's apparent to me anyway that there's a number of working families that are feeling a pinch pretty hard. I think that at $115 a point on average, we're probably going to be meeting less than half of a household's heating costs. Whether or not that's adequate, I'd be loath to really say. But generally speaking, it is a supplemental program in many respects. So
that, maybe to turn that question around a little bit, if the program had more money, would you be able to apply the program money to recipients?
Representative, absolutely.
Okay. Representative Edmund?
Yes, go ahead, Charisse.
Can I find out how many seniors or elders out of the 12,260 applications you received actually are receiving the benefits, just the seniors and elders in the program?
I believe I've got that information here. So please bear with me while I do some shuffling. And if I don't, we can get that. They are a priority population for us, as well as households with children. And I apologize, I don't have that information with me here, but we can get that.
Excellent question. Any follow-ups, Representative Millett?
No. I'd just be curious to see how many seniors and elders are actually applying for that. I noticed that in your slide program that you are running ads in the Senior Voice. Are you running ads in any of the rural newspapers also?
Yes, we do. We actually have it. And excuse me, I do have that information. And the speaker is. I'm sorry.
Is that Representative Millett?
Representative Millett, my apologies. As of February 15th, we had made awards to 5,900 LIHEAP households and about 1,100 Alaska Heating Assistance households. And 2,000 of those households had a disabled resident. 2,200 of those households had an elderly resident. And there's some duplication there. 840 households contained an elderly and a disabled resident.
Okay, thank you.
So, Ron, as a percentage, on a percentage basis, how much of that is of the total 12,000 plus applications? You mentioned there's some duplication, some overlap, but what are we looking at here if we were to ballpark a percentage number in terms of seniors and handicapped recipients?
Being somewhat quantitatively impaired, I'd like to look at a year's worth of data and get that back to you, where we've got a full year. We're still only halfway through processing even the applications we have received. So if it would please the chair, I'd like to get that information from last year so we can give you current up-to-date information on the number of elderly and disabled we've been serving.
Representative Johansson.
Thanks. I may have missed this, so forgive me for asking again, but you've got X number who get assistance, and as opposed to how many who apply, what do you, has that already been asked and I missed that? So you've got X number apply, X number get it, what's the difference? Or does everybody get who applies?
No. I think that probably somewhere on the order of 30% or so of the people that apply are not eligible for one reason or another. But I'll get the specific information for that for 2009 as well.
Let me follow up.
Follow up, Representative Johansson.
Are there a number of people who are eligible who apply who do not get because of lack of funding? Is that a problem?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, it has not been a problem. It has been a problem in the past, but not in the recent past. It is a challenge that some tribal organizations face, where they have eligible households that they cannot serve.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue. Because again, looking at the eligibility that is written down here, and it may be more complicated than what's in the presentation, but I can't for the life of me believe that I would be eligible for this program. And I do heat with oil, as do many people down there. I just don't understand how somebody like me could be eligible, and maybe it's because of the scoring, it tilts it more towards, you know, $50,000 in Ketchikan, you can buy a lot more to get a warm house than you can in rural areas just because of the cost. And so do these scoring factors, is that the attempt to kind of push the money where I would be less likely to get a grant if I were competing with somebody who lived out somewhere else who really needs it? I just can't believe that I'd be eligible for this program. It just blows me away.
Well, and if I could jump in, I'd like to hear the clarification. Are we talking about the ACAP portion of the program?
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be the federal side of the program. So I guess, Ron, when you respond, if you could respond in that way that, you know, would Representative Johansson be eligible for the full amount if we were to apply and be in line to get money through the ACAP program, or would he receive sort of a prorated amount because he wouldn't necessarily apply or be eligible for the federal LIHEAP portion of the program?
He would receive, through the chair for Representative Johansson, if all factors being equal and you completed the application, you provided proof of your heating and utility costs, and based on your household size and whether or not you had an elderly or disabled individual in the household, you, in all likelihood, if you met all those criteria, you would receive an award. The size of that award would be based largely on also on where you, of course, where you live, but where you fall in that income bracket. So, for example, we don't make payments below it for households that have fewer than 2 points, and we round up in the points. So if you were at the very high end of the eligibility criteria, you'd only be getting somewhere on the order of like 30% of the total points. So after we factored in your household's income and, you know, household composition and the type of house you were living in, if you were living in a one-room cabin versus a three-bedroom home, you'd get fewer points. If you were heating with electricity versus oil, you'd get fewer points. So it would really boil down to doing that. And we always tell the public when they call, am I eligible, we always say, you got to apply, because that's, you know, doing it on the fly, of course, is kind of risky business, and we don't want to get people's hopes up. So I do encourage you to apply if you're interested. So the amount of your award could vary significantly. You could fall under that threshold and end up, after all the computations, with only 2.3 points or 1.3 points and not qualify. Hopefully that kind of answered your question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up, I'm not looking to apply. I'm not thinking about applying. I just want to understand the program better, because if I could work the application system and get, even if it's 30% of something, that's still 30% of something that somebody else doesn't get, and I can't, I mean, you know, there's a lot more needy people out there than me, that's for sure. So I just want to understand how, I mean, you know, somebody like me, with less scruples, of course, could possibly work the system. And I don't want that to happen because I think this is for people who really need it. So that's all I'm trying to get to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Response, Ron?
Well, just not everybody that applies receives the assistance. Year-to-date, we have denied 950-some applications for a range of reasons. Over-income is one of the highest one. Oftentimes, people do not complete the application, and it's difficult to make contact with them to get the information in a timely manner. So it's not uncommon for us to have to deny an application because we didn't get some pertinent piece of information or for other reasons as well.
Certainly not going to be over the income threshold.
Representative Peterson, are you also interested in the program?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm not, but I might also qualify. But I was going to ask you now, but the point system, you get more points if you're in a colder climate, you know, if the average temperature, say, for example, Ketchikan is considerably warmer than it would be in Antuvik Pass that you mentioned earlier, he wouldn't get anywhere near as many points for his location within the state.
Through the chair, Representative Pearson, that's correct. The starting point, the community heating points for your community would be lower. And then as you income bracket goes up, ticked off, or you know, how you heat your home would also affect the final calculation of points.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions for, and help me with our last name again, Ron?
Creer.
Okay, for Mr. Creer? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for coming forward, and wish you the best at your next energy hearing here in a few minutes over on the other body. With that, we'd like next to go into what I'll loosely call our round table. We had envisioned having a number of people here so we could have visual cues and actually have people in front of us, but we do have Ms. Jolly here from the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. And what I'd like to do is we had posed two very general questions to all the participants with the thinking that this would spur some follow-up questions. And the first question was basically just to respond to your notion of what the strengths and weaknesses are in terms of delivering energy-related services to rural Alaska. And so, Mr. Hagenson, are you on live, Steve?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon, Steve. If you could put yourself on the record and maybe be the first to respond to the question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Hagenson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And thank you again for this opportunity to testify on the delivery of energy in Alaska. Alaska Energy Authority is not directly in the supply chain of energy services, nor are we the end user. So rather than providing a perspective on issues or solutions, I thought I would just share the current areas of energy utility assistance being provided to AEA to some of the rural utilities. The requests we received at AEA will indicate areas that some utilities believe will need more level of assistance. Sharing them may provide ideas for expansion of services or refocusing of services for increased value of rural utilities. Training programs are typically available to the basic and advanced small diesel power plant operators. Small hydroelectric operators and bulk fuel tank operators. In addition, we routinely have requests for training of power cost equalization clerks, utility business management, well-filled bookkeepers, and electric utility bookkeepers. Technical assistance is also critical and is provided for a wide range of operating areas. These inquiries are as simple as, where do I get my generator part, to our power is out and our generator will not start, to how can we help specify a new generator, to how can I reduce my losses in my distribution system, to how can I control cost and demand-side management, or being first contact in the power plant's controller concern. and we've actually been providing quite a bit, get a lot of response, and we have a great team here on site to help them out if they request that service. Remote monitoring is also a power plant operator's tool that will allow outside assistance to observe the symptoms or offer solutions in real time. The system is currently available to a number of small utilities, about 30 or so, could be expanded to provide value to the larger utilities or more for the smaller utilities to serve multiple sites. The real-time monitoring of power plants can also trend data to provide notification of oil changes to reduce risk of equipment failure or monitor generator efficiency to ensure the lowest cost power. Innovation and technology sharing have resulted in stack heat recovery systems to increase efficiencies. Used oil blenders, which mix used oil with diesel, to be used on-site rather than transporting the oil out for processing and disposal. Networking is critical when optimizing electric utilities. Rather than going it alone, utilities can participate in the Rural Energy Conference or other forums to share what works and, more importantly, what does not work. Emerging technologies may hold too much risk for utilities, so it is critical to have a forum to share lessons learned before making a large investment to deploy a new technology. This concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Hagenson? Not seeing any. Thanks, Steve, and we'll ask you, obviously, to stay online for the second question that we'll pose. I'd like next, Tara, can I have you come up and I think we've got the perfect segue in terms of local capacities and the perspective that your division could provide in terms of capabilities related to energy.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting me be here today. One of the things that
can
we
can I get you put yourself on the record if you would, please?
My name's Tara Jolly. I'm the Director of Community and Regional Affairs with the Department of Commerce. To kind of follow on Steve Hagenson's comments, one of the things that I see is a real need to connect the equation between community stability and consistent administration, keeping the lights on in any public utility, to making energy available to anybody that wants to have any kind of economy or business or anything like that. There's an absolute direct connection. So I would say the strength of DCRA is in providing technical assistance at the community level to consistent administration. I can also tell you that we estimate about 40% of the communities, the very small remote off-road communities, to be less than able to adequately manage their communities. So that's based on data we've collected regarding tax liens and things like that, that the communities need this technical support to manage their public utilities. The public utilities will then allow businesses to operate, you know, to some degree where they can. In a community where one user might run the utility bill up and that money isn't collected, I'm thinking of one in particular, the bill just shut down the whole community because it wasn't collected from a fish processor. So that's how that works. We have local government specialists that can offer that kind of technical assistance. We don't have enough of them. We have applied for more, and we can double our capacity to train people at the local level if that goes through. The other thing in DCRA that is extremely important to small communities is community revenue sharing and the funding for community revenue sharing. One of the challenges we know of is cash flow and the availability of cash at the right time. The seasonality of barge deliveries means that the barge might be headed their way, but their cash flow isn't there yet. So we can work with communities to make sure that we can guarantee to the vendor that they'll get the third-party payment, and then they sign over basically their community revenue shares. We can do that same thing with bulk fuel loans, bridge loans. If a community is turned down for a bulk fuel loan for whatever reason, maybe they already have an outstanding one or something, we We did this last year with, under an initiative called Fuel Watch, where we were able to help about 25 communities get their fuel in a timely way so they could get in on the best price of the day and then pay the vendor on their behalf with either community revenue sharing or a bridge loan, you know, or help them apply for a bulk fuel loan and those kinds of things. So our local government specialists can help communities navigate through those kinds of issues in a streamlined kind of way. So we don't have any control over any prices or anything like that, but we can help make sure fuel's available in those ways. And I'm talking mostly off-road and remote. Last year, we identified over 600 entities that provide fuel in off-road and remote communities. So many of the community revenue checks go straight for fuel, you know. And then last year we had the stimulus money, but that was a one-time thing. And a lot of those went straight for fuel. So of our programs, the two that I feel are the most important is to keep community revenue sharing funded at its level that it was funded last year, and then to hopefully expand on local technical assistance.
Questions for Ms. Jolly, committee members? So Tara, in terms of weaknesses, and I think you basically mentioned it, if you had more staff, I guess, local government specialists who could interact with more communities, that 40% number of communities that aren't functioning at full capacity in terms of administrative capabilities or whatever the term might be, that number would be lessened?
Yes, it would be lessened. I mean, these are issues that keep communities from applying for additional funds that might be available, or it keeps them from paying their bills on time and having good credit, or there might be audit findings that are limiting them from participating in other kinds of things. It's mostly about financial management at the local level. So.
Okay. Well, thank you. And if you want to sit there for the time being, you're more than welcome to. Next, I'd like to go to Mira Kohler. Mira, are you online?
Representative Edgman?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mira.
I think that was Cherise.
I'm sorry? Is that you?
Representative Edgman, I just have a question that I'd like to ask to everybody in the roundtable.
Go ahead, please, Representative Millett.
What I'm curious to know is we have a couple different departments testifying, and I'd like to ask them the question about the Department of Energy or the Office of Energy if they think that is a valuable thing to consider that's in our omnibus bill. So if I could have each of the participants of the roundtable kind of answer that question from their perspective. I know what the consumers feel, but I don't know how they feel.
Okay, so maybe if I could phrase it such that maybe more consolidation or centralization of energy services, Representative Millett, would that be appropriate, whether it be a Department of Energy or an Office of Energy? Is that kind of what you're implying?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Tara, do you want to take the first shot at that? The question being that... Okay, we've got a lot of energy programs. We just heard from LIHEAP, which is the Department of Health and Social Services. We just heard from Mr. Hagenson with the Alaska Energy Authority. Now we're hearing from yourself. You're with the Division of Community Regional Affairs in a different part of the Department of Commerce. You know, without putting you on the spot, knowing that obviously you have to be cognizant of your policy statements with your commissioner's office and the governor's office and so on and forth, but maybe you can respond in the way that... I mean, are you hearing from some of your constituency about sort of the fragmented nature of all these different programs and services related to energy?
Well, I can only say yes. I mean, you know, we hear that, you know, that there's difficulty knowing where to go to ask for answers about questions and things, but I think that's common. I think a lot of people hear that, not just us in DCRA, but, regarding state services, to deliver them in one place is, it's kind of difficult to navigate the system, and that's what we help a lot with, is helping people navigate, and we also have several efforts where we collaborate across agencies and things to try to address that, because it is siloed somewhat.
Okay. I think that parallels what this committee has heard throughout the various trips that we have taken throughout rural Alaska and certainly urban Alaska, and I appreciate you being candid with that. Mr. Hagenson, did you want to respond to Representative Millett's question as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We haven't heard. I mean, let me maybe clarify. Tara, my phone's ringing back to me. Let me clarify a point that Tara made. Centralizing statewide services and centralizing energy services may be two different points. So I'd like to talk about just the energy services. I personally haven't heard too many concerns about people not knowing where to go to ask about energy things, but again, I'm also kind of one of the energy guys, so I guess it wouldn't make sense if they went to the wrong place, they wouldn't be asking me the question. So I guess I just want to make that point that this is really energy specific. I think Representative Millett's question was energy specific, not just statewide access to statewide services.
Mr. Hagenson, I think, and Representative Millett, please chime in here. I think the nature of the question was all-encompassing, and hence the need for consolidation or the bringing together of all these various programs, entities, services, supply side, demand side, whatever it might be, but all related to energy, the energy field.
Representative Edgeman, I would agree with that, but I was trying to, what I heard Tara say was that it was kind of a lot of just statewide, kind of a generalized statewide services. And I think I would agree with the question and that it's specifically to energy stuff or energy related services. And I think there's about maybe four or five places. I guess consolidation is always a good thing. And one-stop shopping is a good place. And I think I'm sure there are places that we could consolidate in that area.
Okay. Well, we have two out of our five participants participating so far, and I was just about to call on Ms. Kohler-Mira. Are you online?
I am.
And okay, great. We sort of have two questions now in play. First, if you could address the issue of sort of the strengths and weaknesses in delivering energy services to rural Alaska, and then afterwards we'll ask you about the question that's on the table, and that's sort of the consolidation of the state part of the equation.
All right, and did you want me to address the second question, which was tools the legislature could provide to help in delivering the service?
Sure, if you would.
All right. Well, I did. I'm sorry I'm not there in person. This is Mira Kohler. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. I had actually scheduled to fly down this afternoon, and I didn't get in until 2:30 this morning from Atlanta, so things have kind of gotten a little complicated on me. In any case, I did send in to Adam earlier today a copy of my remarks, so you can share those with each other later on, but I will go ahead and go through that at this point. In terms of strengths and weaknesses of delivering energy-related service to rural Alaska, energy-related services are twofold, electricity and liquid fuels. Nowhere in the modern world are residents of hundreds of communities as economically and situationally disadvantaged as our rural Alaskans. Communities are extremely small, from less than 40 to a few thousand population, with more than 200 of those communities being smaller than 500 people. And they are spread out geographically over a vast and inhospitable terrain. The generation and distribution of electricity is a complex system, yet such systems are operated on an isolated basis in virtually every location. The state attempts to provide a modest level of technical support for standalone communities, but such services fall dismally short as a stand-in for competent local operations. Per capita electricity consumption in rural Alaska is about 50% of that in urban Alaska, reflecting classic price elasticity. The high cost of electricity is compensated for through conservation, leaving very little for additional conservation measures. Petroleum fuels represent two-thirds to three-quarters of energy consumed by Alaskans and drive the enormous cost that energy represents in the average rural Alaskan budget. Again, the minuscule local market necessarily results in very high local fuel costs. There is also currently much confusion about implementation of ultra-low sulfur diesel rules in rural Alaska. There are very few strengths in the rural Alaska energy situation. However, one of those could be virtual immunity to terrorism and cyber attacks. The weaknesses are extremely small markets, very high investment per consumer for electric systems, modest human capacity for highly technical generation systems, especially alternative and renewable energy systems, market isolation resulting in vulnerability to extended outages due to storm and other conditions, conservation and efficiency efforts resulting in further compression of already marginal economies of scale, oppressed economic development due to very high energy costs, limited job opportunities globally, resulting in out-migration of the most talented and capable workforce towards better opportunities. So the second question was tools the legislature could provide to help
in suffering. Can I jump in? What we're doing here is we're, and I apologize for the sort of clumsy way that this might be unfolding, but what we're trying to do is start with the first question and then have follow-up questions from committee members, and then if I could ask you here in a moment address Representative Miller's question about the consolidation of sort of the state side of the energy end of things. So we're still on question one. I'm going to look around the table here and see if there's any sort of follow-up questions from committee members. I don't see any, but I'd like to ask for you, and this might take us somewhat into question number two, but be it as it may, I just heard you mention similarly to what Ms. Jolly had just talked about, and actually Mr. Hagenson to a degree as well, is that we have a lack of a sort of technical capability in a lot of our smaller communities throughout the state. And obviously the budget simply isn't going to support putting 30 or 40 local government specialists in terms of the Division of Community Regional Affairs. Given that reality, what would you suggest in terms of being able to reach out and provide these technical services that not only can save a lot of these communities a lot of money, but I think also in the scheme of things, help them bring in money in terms of being more sophisticated, being able to leverage the money that they do have there at the local level?
Well, Representative Edgman, the reality, as I pointed out earlier, is that we have a unique situation here in Alaska where we actually have generation on site in every community. That is not the norm. Everywhere else in the country and in the world, communities are interconnected with transmission lines and generation is centralized. So you can have the expertise in the location of the centralized generation. And so, for example, for many of our villages, like what we have done at AVEC, we put in our power plant and wind generation in Tuxuk Bay, and we built lines to connect to other communities to it. So by connecting these communities, you take away the necessity for a high level of technical competence in two of the communities, and you focus on one. And when you divide, you can conquer. So if you could reduce the number of communities that have standalone generation systems from 300 to 100, you're going to develop tremendous economies of scale, and you're going to be able to take what technical competence there is and focus it in those smaller areas or in those larger areas, if you will. So that is part of the solutions that I do propose, is that we do have to get realistic and aggressive about interconnecting communities and creating, if nothing else, virtual grids to try and get these communities consolidated.
Okay. Thank you, Mira. And then the question that Representative Millett had just posed was about the consolidation of state services.
I think the concept is an excellent one. Right now, you have energy services being delivered by a myriad of organizations. You have various departments within community and economic development, as in DCRA, the RUBA program, the Alaska Energy Authority. You've got training that's conducted by different entities within the same umbrella. AEA does training, RUBA does training. You've got fuel services being assisted in terms of AEA does do some of the loan program, and DCRA through RAFS does another portion of it. You've got the LIHEAP program that's run by a whole other department. You've got, you know, the query that I run into is when we're talking about all energy programs under one roof, are we talking about larger programs such as gas and petroleum or crude oil? Or are we just talking about retail-type services, which I do feel would benefit greatly from consolidation? You know, you've also got AHSC with their weatherization program. To me, all of these programs are so closely interrelated that they would definitely benefit from being under one roof.
Okay. Thank you. So what I'm going to do next is go to Mr. Breen. Bob, are you online?
I am online, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. If you could put yourself on the record and address question number one, which was to discuss the strengths and weaknesses in delivering services out to rural Alaska.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with the committee and others on these issues. Basically, AHSC is more involved in the demand side of the energy picture as opposed to the supply side. So a lot of what we do is directly relative to residential and some commercial aspects of the demand side or the energy use side of the equation. In talking about strength, to get right to the question, Mr. Chairman, one of the models that we have used over many years, and it's worked quite well for us, is to actually subcontract out to regional entities. We currently work with 5 weatherization contractors that are provide service statewide. We've worked with them for a number of years. We also work with 12 regional housing authorities, which in my opinion are probably some of the most wherewithal affluent organizations out in Bush, Alaska, and across the state in terms of housing and infrastructure development. So through those contracts that we have with them, we basically empower them. We provide technical assistance on different aspects of the program, but ultimately we ask them to deliver our programs on our behalf. And as a result, not only are we empowering them with financial wherewithal, but also we're providing an opportunity to them to retain jobs and create jobs. So the model works very well for us in terms of program delivery as well as creating and retaining jobs. We think that model really is one of our great strengths, and we've seen historically it proven itself out over time. On the second question, Mr. Chairman, with regard to weaknesses, I think Tara Jolly from DCRA really, really was hitting on the issue as I see it. I have to say that I'm biased here because I'm an old DCRA guy, but when you're looking at rural communities, there's no way that you can simply look at the energy issues in a vacuum without considering other aspects of community development. And what the status of the local economy is, because essentially there's only so much money in that community. And if, for example, they have invested in capital projects 10, 15 years ago, they may still be in the process of amortizing that project. In the meantime, the population continues to grow. And then if you bring a new project in that requires additional upfront capital investment, while the community really is still carrying a very heavy debt load to amortize an old project, basically they're unable to afford a new project that may even translate into energy savings down the line. But my drift here is that a lot of times, because of older capital projects, the city or community is still strapped with that debt-to-equity ratio, and quite honestly, has a difficult time bringing on new capital projects. One of the things that we used to do back in the day with DCRA was try to coordinate all the aspects of local economic development with new projects necessary for the community to sustain itself. And one of the things that was created way back when, and I think is still a very valuable tool, is the RAPIDS database that DCRA has. But I guess what I'm focusing on here a little bit is the weakness piece, which is I think all aspects of energy projects really need to be coordinated with local economic development aspects. Projects need to be coordinated so that you can gain those economies of scale on freighting materials to a community, coordinating dirt work with water and sewer projects, and as Tara mentioned earlier, doing an analysis of the financial situation in that community to see whether or not they can actually afford a new capital project, whether it be water and sewer, a new power plant, new windmill, new road, new solid waste disposal facility. So I think the issue of coordinating a number of aspects of community development is where there's a lot of room to do better. We could do better. We had an agency that basically did that full time. It is now a division within Commerce, and quite honestly, you know, the Department of Community and Regional Affairs is quite good at it, but now they have limited resources. On the issue of consolidation of state services, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, you know, our play is predominantly on the demand side. We don't get into the supply side as much as other agencies. We think that that in terms of consolidation, you know, I think the model that DCRA was years ago is a great model of consolidating. But again, you know, I want to qualify that. I don't think it's necessarily limited to energy. I think you've got to look at multiple aspects of economic development in rural Alaska in order to make it work. We think there's a lot of merit to that. In terms of our formal position with regard to energy specific, as I said, our focus is predominantly on the demand side, the use of energy, and I think our chief executive officer and our board of directors has talked about this issue. I think our CEO is on the record, his position with regard to consolidation of services in a single agency. I'm really not at liberty to take a position. I think it's really up to the CEO and our board of directors to vocalize our position on that question.
Thank you, Bob. Not seeing any follow-up questions. If you could also stand by, and we'll come back to our second question. I would like to next go to Joel Niemeyer. Joel, are you online?
Yes, Joel Niemeyer here, the new federal co-chair of the Denali Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to the committee. I'm going to address a couple things, and then I'm going to turn it over to Denali Daniels, who manages our energy program. First, we have no position on the consolidation or the new or the discussion of changing state government. I think in some respects that may be inappropriate for us because we are striving to have a very strong state-federal relationship. We want to have a very strong relationship with our commissioners. And one of our commissioners is the state co-chair, is Karen Rayfield. And so I would defer to her to speak on behalf of the commission. So that would be our position that we haven't taken one. With regard to the request of the testimony today, I will share with you that the commission is a unique model where seven Alaskans have been delegated by Congress to make choices, funding choices. And over the past 10 years, they've made choices almost to $1 billion. But it's not those seven Alaskans. We have many other Alaskans who support them in that process. We have an energy advisory committee, which there are seven, of which a couple of them are our commissioners. And so the questions that were posed to us, we put out to our advisory committee and aggregated their thoughts, and Denali Daniels will now represent those thoughts.
Thank you, Joel. For the record, my name is Denali Daniels. I manage the energy program for the Denali Commission. In terms of strengths, as Joel indicated, we actually went through quite a process after this request came to our attention. I've got three bullets here, really, that best represent the Commission's standpoint in terms of strength. There appears to be an increased motivation on behalf of communities, a perceived attitude shift toward greater self-sufficiency, and perhaps an entrepreneurial spirit existing across the state in response to the ongoing energy challenges. Many regional entities, for-profit, non-profit, CDQs, appear to be strong at this time. In some places, such as the community of Chivac, the local city and tribal governments are actually formalizing coordination agreements to become more effective and are in turn becoming more self-sufficient as a community. Specific to the Denali Commission's energy program, over the past 11 years, the Commission, along with other government and private funders, have elevated standards for communities that wish to receive funding. Most noteworthy, this is through a sustainability requirement for infrastructure development, and really the funding for that development. The Denali Commission has invested over $350 million in basic energy infrastructure statewide. The majority of that has been dedicated to bulk fuel storage and rural power system upgrades, in addition to renewable and alternative energy projects. And the result there has been 93 communities in which their bulk fuel facilities have been either upgraded or replaced, and 46 communities that have received either upgraded or replaced rural power systems. And so that's where we stop talking about strengths, and we can certainly address the weaknesses, challenges, and tools for the legislature when called upon.
Okay. If you would, Denali.
We actually are having somewhat of trouble hearing you all. And so could you repeat that again, please?
Sure. Let me try it again. I just heard Denali conclude with sort of the strengths portion of the question, and now if we could turn towards sort of what you view as some of the challenges or the weaknesses or the lack of capacity issues or whatever it might be from your perspective. But
okay. So from the Denali Commission's perspective, we do have a few bullets that folks provided input on. While we've invested in a number of communities, over 150 communities in the programs that I just described, a substantial need exists in the remaining communities, and those communities, by and large, are perhaps some of the most challenging communities with regard to capacity. According to our numbers, up to 66 communities remain on the bulk fuel deficiency list. Many of those may not receive a bulk fuel facility, but it could be up to that number. We simply don't know at this point in time. Our estimates, if that number were the case, for bulk fuel amounts to $257 million in remaining need just to meet the bulk fuel facility upgrades based on that community number. The Rural Power System Upgrade Program is behind that, and we currently have 78 communities on that list. We do not have a cost estimate for the remaining need. We recognize that that is central to intertie development that is currently underway, and so it's a moving target in terms of estimates. Secondly, those projects that have received new infrastructure funding were at the time required to develop a business plan, and that was part of our sustainability requirement. And yet we know that that really has just been a snapshot in time, and one of the challenges from the Commission standpoint is that we have limited authority to enforce adherence to those business plans. once the grant has been expended and grant agreements have been closed. And so one of the things that we ought to be looking at is alternatives for post-grant compliance after the infrastructure is already in place, recognizing the goal, of course, is for that infrastructure to last around 30 years. And then finally, in terms of weaknesses and challenges, the Denali Commission's funding is declining with new leadership in Washington, D.C. There's a greater need for state support for the Commission's programs in order to leverage federal funding. And so the need still exists. There's still a substantial amount of need, and the state support is going to be necessary. That concludes the weaknesses and challenges.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Daniels. Question, Representative Johansson?
Yeah, neither one of you wanted to comment on, I guess, the state structure or, I guess, question number two, but can I ask, in your day-to-day dealings with trying to get energy projects and things done with the state, how many different divisions, departments, authorities, loan funds, granting authorities, instruments of the state do you guys deal with? Is it one, five, eight?
This is Joel Niemeyer. You're breaking up, but I think I know where you're going with this, but let me share this, and you tell me if this is what you're trying to get to. From my work in rural Alaska, and I've been working for 25 years, and in the last 10 or 11, I've paid attention to energy issues because I worked here originally at the commission over 10 years ago on energy issues. One of the things I see, and it's not just solely with the state, but I see it with federal agencies and I see it with stakeholder groups, are silos of funding and silos of program. And I would think, and what that serves to do, that serves to, I don't want to say, stifle creativity, but I think there may be some opportunities that end up being lost. And so one of the things I would think is as the legislature struggles with the idea of how to better provide state services in the energy sector, those things that you can do that can help reduce those silos or make those silos work better with one another would be very helpful. Shall I give you an example?
Well, that's good enough for me, but if the chairman wants to keep going down that track, I'm satisfied with the answer.
Representative Peterson?
Sure, I'd be happy to hear an example.
Well, one of the things, I'll just use energy efficiency as an opportunity. You go into a rural community, you may have anywhere from 20 to 40 community buildings represented, and there may be seven or eight major different funding streams that may be interested in energy efficiency on those community buildings. You could have school districts, you have tribal buildings, you have sanitation facilities, you have power plants, you could have armories, National Guard armies. You've got all these different potential funding sources. An energy efficiency project for a community building, say a 2,000 square foot community building, is going to be relatively modest. Now, you take that across 200 communities, so you try to coordinate the funding streams from seven or eight different prospective partners across 200 communities for a little bit of money. That's incredibly complex and incredibly difficult. But if there were some way in which you could have bridge funding or some way in which you could connect those different funding streams in a larger scale. So let's say everyone decides that they're going to work together on Kodiak Island. And so we bring together all our resources. We all agree we're going to do energy efficiency for the 150 community buildings on Kodiak Island, short of Kodiak proper. Then we have some opportunity to leverage those funds. We've got economy of scale, and we don't make it inordinately administratively bureaucratic or difficult for the community to develop small energy efficiency projects across multiple community buildings. But we all know that in the end, if you do those energy efficiency, those small projects on those 20 or 40 buildings, you can have a significant impact on reducing the energy footprint in those communities. To me, that's an example of the silos I was talking about.
Well, I appreciate the answer, Joel, and it's really interesting, you know, just sitting here thinking that we have key participants. I mean, really, if you focus at the way services are delivered at the regional level out in Bush, Alaska, we have a couple of key participants who aren't at the discussion today, and one is the regional not-for-profits, and another is the regional housing authorities. And I know from my experience in the Bristol Bay region, for example, that the Bristol Bay Native Association in some ways is the de facto Department of Energy. But then if I rise above the Bristol Bay Native Association, and I've heard this time and time again, not just today, but in all of our trips around the state and through all the number of hearings that we've had, you've got all these, as you aptly described, all these sort of silos protruding out of the various parts of the statewide directory of services and programs, and certainly on the federal end as well. And so I think you've, you know, your points have very much paralleled what the committee has observed as well, and what Mr. Breen and Ms. Jolly and Ms. Kohler have all talked about. And so with that, I would like to, given that we've got about 35 minutes or so before the top of the hour, if we could circle back and address question number two, which we have in some respect already touched upon. And that would be, you know, what specific recommendations might you have for us here in the legislature, if any at all, in terms of improving the situation at hand? So I'll start with the top of our list. Mr. Hagenson, I know you're online, and we get to hear from you frequently, and I know you have some requests perhaps already in the budget, but to the extent that you can, what would, you know, what can we do to help out?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Steve Hagenson again. Part of the issue, I guess I'm going to back up and say that there's Alaska has a couple curses, and they're low usage and long distance. And I think it kind of trickles through the response on every one of the things we do. So one observation is that what I'd like to see is a conversation among the rural utilities about coordinating in a similar manner as we do with the GRETC, right now the Greater Rail Belt Energy Transmission Corporation, and that would put them under one umbrella and let them coordinate together, and that would help solve some remote monitoring issues, because one entity could then be remote monitoring. The same entity could be doing bulk fuel purchases, consolidation of planning efforts of construction and financing app opportunities. So and that way you get the economies of scale that you really need. I'd also like to have listened to their discussion about the business model they want to pick, whether it's a G&T or a Congressy organization or something. But I think it's really, I can tell you that it's not a cakewalk going down that conversation path. Just getting six utilities and rail belt on one sheet of paper has been quite a bit of work, and I think you're probably more familiar with that than most people in the Hill, because you're working with them on it, both you and the co-chair of Millett. But I think that could be an ultimate solution. But again, before, instead of saying, here's what you should do, I think we need to listen to the community about the solution that they want to pick for their area, because it's a lot easier herding cats if you get them all trained at the same time.
Well, with that said, Mr. Hagenson, let me give you an opportunity to promote the Rural Energy Conference in April. I think the Alaska Energy Authority plays a big role in that. Is that April 27th, 28th, Fairbanks?
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
It's the 27th through 29th.
27th through 29th. Okay. Well, I'm going to sort of switch orders here a little bit and turn to Mira. Do you want to respond to some of the comments that Mr. Hagenson has made?
Sure. This is Mira Kohler at ABEC again. And what Steve is saying pretty much echoes what I've been saying for the last year or so, maybe in a slightly different context, but... and what I have said earlier today, which is that we do need to have some sort of a parallel All-Alaska G&T type concept for rural Alaska that would consolidate competent operations under one roof and be able to supply the type of support necessary to operate a competent utility. the issue always becomes how would something like that be funded, and it was my thought to tag it on with a grid C type concept, because if we can get all behind major projects that serve the largest amount of the population in the state, for example, something that brings down the cost of power for the rail belt, and then those benefits could be spread back to operate competent utilities in rural Alaska, and investments will only be made where they're the most practical to make. Instead of having, you know, four wind machines or six wind machines in every village, you may very well focus on a Bethel and a Nome and a Kotzebue and then spread those benefits across the state. So that is the idea that I've been promoting for some time. The issue becomes, how do you sell it? Well, you sell it by demonstrating that the benefits far outweigh the costs. And that's how you sell it both to the local communities as well as to the legislature. So, you know, I hope that we can work together on developing that concept. I haven't read what I had written down here, but what I did write down is the legislature needs to adopt and fund an aggressive plan to connect Alaskan communities to a common grid. In some cases physical, in some cases virtual. Consolidation of power generation systems will deliver lower operating costs as number of generation units decrease, higher efficiencies since larger generation is typically more efficient, better economies of scale to spread the fixed costs over, the ability to pay more to attract higher caliber staff, higher capacity to incorporate renewable technologies as transmission lines make more prospects viable. So that is the one aspect of the tool the legislature could use to assist rural Alaska. The next item I have is that the legislature, working with private industry, needs to aggressively assure broadband internet access across rural Alaska. The lack of true commercial-grade service has severely hampered operation of management and control capability for extremely sophisticated control systems that are necessary to properly integrate renewable alternative energy technologies in rural Alaska. And broadband internet service also assures economic development because you have a viable pipeline to the lower 48. The legislature also needs to ensure that a comprehensive communication plan is developed to assist rural Alaska in complying with EPA rules regarding conversion to ultra-low sulfur diesel. This is a major issue this year. We had formed a small task force that was working on developing a communication plan to rural Alaska, but it appears that communication plan is going to be developed by the EPA instead, and I haven't heard anything about what's going to happen with that. I know that there's a lot of fear and concern in villages that a replicative delivery system is going to have to be developed very soon to receive ultra-low sulfur diesel, so that needs to be addressed and resolved. And going back to Representative Millett's question on an umbrella energy organization, I do want to point out that while these services are being provided by numerous departments under various of the department divisions in the state of Alaska, there's not one single one of them that actually has a cabinet-level position that has a direct line to the governor to ensure that energy gets the attention that it needs at the very highest level. So that is a strong statement in support of consolidated energy programs. And I will just throw out, for those of you that aren't aware, ICER just today issued a report about rural Alaska fuel costs, and I urge you to take a look at that. And what it really points out is that there's probably not a whole lot that can be done about a lot of rural fuel costs. And I will also take this opportunity to tell you today that AVEC just very recently in the last 10 days has taken action to move forward to actually have built for us two new tugs and barges, and we're going to be helping to bring more competition to the Western Alaska fuel market.
Representative Edgman, Chairman Edgman, I have a question.
Co-Chair Millett.
Thanks, Mira. One of the things I want to talk to you about is your virtual G&T. We have in front of us, or we'll have in front of us pretty soon, the Gretzky legislation. And one of the things that we've kind of been tossing around is RCA oversight for something like that. Can you tell me how consumers are protected if there is no RCA oversight on a large scale co-op like this? If there's no RCA
oversight, what's the consumer protection?
Well, I can point to AVEC itself. Now, AVEC, of course, is sort of an umbrella cooperative, and we serve 53 villages. We are not economically regulated by the RCA. We are regulated as to our PCE rate, and so it's through that process, essentially, we go through something very similar to what the rate regulated utilities go through, except that we are not subject to as stringent RAPA-type investigations that the RCA does. So now, all of rural Alaska rolled together does not make a true catch. So, you know, the relative size of serving rural Alaska and serving a rail belt utility is really dramatically, dramatically different. And that would need to be taken a look at. I think that, for the most part, the nonprofit organizations, the municipals, and the cooperatives like ourselves are effectively regulated by our local boards of directors. That's not necessarily the case with the investor-owned utilities, and there are a few investor-owned utilities in Alaska. Case in point is Bethel, which, of course, is the, you know, we see a lot of strife and strain over Bethel, and I don't want to say anything bad about them, but nonetheless, they are rate regulated by the RCA, and yet I believe that their customers are less adequately served than are our customers at AVEC.
Follow up for Representative Millett.
Well, it's just one of those questions that as we go forward, because the GRETC legislation is something that will be modeled, I think, that we've talked about being modeled statewide, that I'm interested in how, you know, MIRA sees how we could model that, you know, statewide, but with some consumer protections or just at least with some consumer confidence. And I think that that's, you know, that's kind of what I'm looking for, is some guidance on where that balance is between not over-regulating utilities but also regulating for consumer protections.
And I think that that's going to be a work in progress, and that we need to sit at the table and come up with a model that would be acceptable to all. Remember, regulation comes at great cost, and that is something that we don't necessarily want to pass on to the end users. So we want to find the best balance, as you said, and I think that can be relatively easily achieved in a smaller community than it can in a larger community.
Thanks, Mary. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Okay, before we go to Tara, who's here at the committee room in Juneau, I just want the record to note that Kathy Wasserman from the Alaska Municipal League has been sitting in the audience listening very attentively. Kathy, and thanks for being here and participating by way of listening. Tara, your comments on what I think we've heard in part some of your sort of recommendations or suggestions, but you've had the opportunity to hear from a few of the other folks online and what might you recommend?
Thank you. This is Tara Jolly again. There's been such good testimony and dialogue here. It's been real helpful. What I'd like to provide for clarification is what Steve Hagenson highlighted when I was asked about any kind of consolidation. I certainly didn't think of just energy. I went right past that and thought of energy as a subset of a more comprehensive menu of services. So just for clarification. On the recommendations, I would then again go back to what I think are the two key components from a DCRA perspective. That is to try to always provide full funding for community revenue sharing, because that is so critical and so important that happens. And then again, go on a little bit more with Bob Breen's dialogue, talking about that holistic, comprehensive approach to community development that is so key in the smaller communities, and the collaboration of activities and the idea that you have to look at everything as a whole as to investments and cash flow and whether or not a community can support something. So that community development is so key that to the community stability that I'd just like to reiterate that we would like to be able to have about three people to provide those kinds of services throughout the state of 386 entities that we know of, you know. So it's not a large number of people, but it's three. To add to three we have. And so that's the kind of level of assistance we feel like we need to provide that kind of assistance. And that would be the only comments that I have. So,
well, let me ask you this, Tara. What kind of partnership opportunities do you have with the tribes scattered throughout the state?
With tribal entities? We work with the tribes all the time. We work with nonprofits. We work with tribal councils, in some cases where the tribal council is the administrative entity in a community or active on in pursuit of, say, a community development block grant or something like that. We work with tribal councils. We work with housing authorities. We work with the city administration. We work with municipalities. So we don't have barriers of any sort.
So when you say 386 entities scattered across the state, you mean all of the above that you just mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we don't have 386 municipalities.
Right.
In the state.
We have 232 about that are municipalities and unincorporated that receive community revenue sharing checks.
Okay. Well, Mr. Breen, you had some really intriguing comments earlier. Do you want to take a crack at covering, I think, ground we sort of already covered before, but what can we do here at maybe in terms of helping out at the legislative level?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is excellent dialogue, and I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of it. A couple of things, I guess, from AHFC's perspective, and maybe I'll broaden it a little bit from there, but one of the things that we're trying to do this legislative session, Mr. Chairman, is we're proposing an energy efficiency revolving loan fund, and there's a couple of pieces of legislation out there promoting it. And our idea there is to take about $18 million of the $28 million that we're getting from stimulus money from the federal government, and using that as seed money for the creation of a revolving loan fund. We feel that with our mechanisms and vehicles here at HFC, that we can leverage that $18 million into potentially $250 to $275 million. As you know, Mr. Chairman, it's not cheap to do retrofits in Bush, Alaska, or anywhere in Alaska where you have long distances and logistics to contend with. And our thought is that rather than try to do what we can for $18 million, use it to leverage another $250 million, and then we have a meaningful program that would be available to municipalities and schools and state agencies for doing some energy conservation retrofits on larger facilities. And we think that legislation, Mr. Chairman, has a lot of merit. The other piece that we see, just kind of trying to look down the path into the future, we are having great success with the weatherization program. The $200 million that was appropriated a couple of years ago is we've got $70 million actually out on the street. We anticipate we'll be fully encumbered on that money by 2011. The rebate program, the $160 million, is all fully obligated right now. And in the process, especially on the weatherization side, we had all of our contractors, which are the five statewide and the 12 regional housing authorities, are all starting to ramp up with regard to their staffs, their jobs, their people, their capacity, their shipping of materials. And we see that continuing to climb until 2011. And I think it's worth thinking about. You know, I'm not advocating for more money, but what I am talking about here is avoiding the boom-bust situation. If we have these subcontractors all ramped up, it's not going to get any cheaper than right then at that particular time to do a continuum of the program to do more. It is our our anticipation that you know, we could save like maybe 10 to 15% by avoiding a ramp down and ramp up. We think there's a lot of merit to looking at some kind of a continuum of those programs. Our estimate right now is we're creating about between 2,000 and 2,500 jobs, and that's not counting jobs being retained. So, you know, you can see the value just in terms of jobs of the ramp up, you know, there's a lot of work to do. We anticipate with that money we'll be able to do 10% of the houses that need to be done. But if we had a boom bust or a ramp up, ramp down situation, we could lose efficiencies by not remaining static with the level of funding, so that we could do more.
Okay, very good, Mr. Breen. As we begin to bring today's session to a close, I'd like to ask all the participants if there's any closing comments or any additional thoughts that you'd like to share with the committee today. Not
here. This is Mira. I just jump in real quick. I just wanted to say that I really, really appreciate the work that the committee has put into the project, and I hope that we will continue on it. I recognize that this particular is going to end in a couple of months, and we may not have everything nailed down, but I hope we'll make sense progress and address it perhaps in the next year or so and get it wrapped up.
Okay, very good, Mira. Let me just make a couple of closing comments before we adjourn the meeting, and that is to say, Mr. Breen, that actually the bill that you referred to, House Bill 296, is scheduled for a hearing next Tuesday in front of the committee. And so we'll be taking that issue up, and that's the bill that would give HFC the bonding authority to take the $18 million and leverage that into $250 million. Day after tomorrow, on Saturday, we're going to shift gears a little bit, the committee, and hold a Saturday hearing to look at a number of sort of larger projects, if you will, and from the scope of project timeline, financing, the feasibility, to get sort of a snapshot of where projects such as the Siri coal gasification effort is at, the Fire Island Wind Farm, the Mount Spur Geothermal Project. Bob Swenson will be here to talk about the Gas Line Project. TDX will be here with Chaka Chamna. And Alaska Energy Authority will be here to discuss the Susitna projects, but to have sort of another roundtable, if you will, but to shift the focus a little bit away from providing services directly out to rural Alaska, as we talked about today, but to look more at larger projects that might have more of a statewide service capability, and to get, again, sort of an update on where these projects are, what their needs might be from the legislature, and what it would take to move those projects forward. Before we wrap things up today, I want to thank all of our panel participants for being part of this conversation, for asking questions that in some respects were maybe a little dicey if you happen to be part of a state agency, or Steve with Alaska Energy Authority, and so on and so forth. But I'll close by saying that if there are any additional comments that are written in nature, please submit those, and as always, feel free to contact my office, Representative Edgman, or Co-Chair Millett's office with any comments, suggestions, any contributions to the Omnibus Energy Bill, House Bill 305, which is presently before this committee and will be coming up here in the near term, and any of the other of myriad of other legislative items, whether it be in the category of a bill or certainly in the budget, too. And Vice Chair Johansson, do you have a closing comment?
Just for Mira, because I know she's listening and we're not done with the committee hearing yet, I just want to remind her that I heard her say she wants to build some fuel vessels, and just letting you know, we can do that down in Ketchikan if you're interested. Just reminding everybody, we can do that. So look into it, and you may be getting some phone calls.
Well, actually, we're already underway with it, so.
Excellent.
Stay tuned.
Co-Chair Millett, any final comments?
No, I just want to thank all the participants. I think this is a continuing conversation that we need to have, and I think it's great that everybody's very engaged. And Amira's right. We need to continue down this path and make some good decisions for the future of the state.
Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we got some excellent input today, different perspectives from different parts of the state and different departments, and it'll all help when it comes time to put the final bill together. So I think it was a good 2 hours spent.
Okay. With that, once again, thanks to everyone, and we will adjourn the meeting at approximately 4:45 today.